Episode 333, Chapter 4, Book Talk begins at 12 minutes.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion.
Episode 333, Reconnaissance.
This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business.
Links to all of our sponsors' pages can be found in the show notes at craftlit.com. Remember, their support for the show is what keeps it free for you. So go take a look. Well, hello. I am back from the warm part of the country. And warm, it was actually beautiful in Florida. Not humid, mid-60s, sunshiny. We did have a little cloud cover, which was certainly not a bad thing. And I have to tell you, I kind of wasn't sure if I was really going to like the theme park thing in Orlando. And we spent time at Epcot. We spent time at the little Harry Potter Hogsmeade station area. And then a little bit of time at regular Disney Magic Kingdom stuff and on rides at Universal. And I was really impressed. I was really impressed with the people who worked there. Those are hard, hard jobs. And we actually got to spend some time talking to, this sounds bizarre, the woman who was playing Lucille Ball on the street at Universal Studios. And so this woman, it's such a weird thing. She is in character in that her name is Lucy Arnaz. She is dressed like Lucy from one of the shows. She has all of the history knowledge of Lucy and the things that she did and the things that she pioneered in her business and all of this stuff. And yet she was absolutely aware that she was in a modern setting. So she was talking about the Transformers ride and Octopus Prime, which those of you who have young boys and some girls will get. She was very, very funny. But then there were also people who she recognized because they came to that park often. And she made a big deal about going up and thanking them and saying hi. These were considerably older people who I was surprised were at the park at all in the middle of this kind of melee on a Saturday. And one family had an older man who was in a wheelchair who I believe had had some sort of stroke at some point. She sat down next to him and just had a lovely conversation. And he really didn't understand that she was not actually Lucille Ball. And so for him, this was huge. He was having an opportunity to have what kind of conversation he could have with her. And she was marvelous. And I thought, okay, first off, what an amazing kind of person to be able to improvise that level of information and character acting. But then on another level, what a lovely human being. You know, she wasn't shy. She wasn't waiting for people to come up to her. She was putting herself out there. But she was putting herself out there to people who really could benefit from something like that. And we saw that over and over again at the Universal Park. And then Epcot was just way more interesting than I had expected. I really didn't know that we were going to wind up spending that much time there. The boys wanted to do this test track thing where you could design a car and then test that car on a test track. And I was very impressed with the way they did it. It was very clever. Everybody had an opportunity to, quote unquote, design a car. There were certain parameters, like you could go for economy, you could go for materials, you could go for power, you could go for speed, you could go for all of these things and then choose different attributes you wanted your car to have. And then you could choose a body type. And then they put you in a car with six other people. And I'm thinking, well, why did we go through all of that figuring out what we wanted our car to look like? It's because they programmed your car's attributes into the system. They know you're there because they did a little fingerprint thingy. So they know it's you. And you went in this generic car. You went through a bunch of tests. And then at the end of each one of these road tests, they would show on a panel how your car, with its parameters, would have done on that test. So there was a power test, there was an efficiency test, there was a speed test, which was a lot of fun, that was outside. And they went 0 to 60 in like 5 seconds. It was great for little people who want to go fast and big people who like going fast. It was a lot of fun. And my mom and I were just cackling. We were having such a great time. And it was really interesting. And then afterwards, it spits you out, instead of spitting you out into a gift shop, it spits you out into a larger test center where you could do kind of these thought experiment tests digitally on other kinds of attributes and things that you would want to add to or take away from your car. It was fantastic. It was really, really smart. And then, of course, there's the whole world marketplace where you can travel from Mexico to Norway in 5 minutes. So it was loads of fun. We had a very good time and we stayed warm and we did not get snowed on, which it's the first time in my life that I've ever had this much luck. We got to the airport as the storm was closing in. We took off before the snow started to fall. And once we landed, we saw that every other flight had gotten canceled because of the storm that we had escaped. And then the 2 days that we were down there, the boys had snow days. So they didn't actually miss any school. It was extraordinary. Nothing like that has ever happened. So I hope that my good luck rubs off on all of us and we all have a fantastic 2014 because we all deserve it. God knows many of us have had some pretty lousy years the last couple. So there it is. And on the, wow, things are interesting in 2014 side of things. If all goes well, when this episode posts, I will be poking around Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey. And I will be doing reconnaissance. My plan is Friday morning to go and visit a number of schools and talk to the school secretaries in these different towns that we're looking at. Because it's my belief is that the school secretaries know everything. And I have some fairly tricky children, and I want to make sure we get them into the right schools. And then I'm going to go by real estate offices and find out what the rental market looks like in these places. And then I'm going to go plant myself at coffee shops or coffee houses in different places and eavesdrop and find out what the people who are there during the day are like. So I can kind of get a vibe for the place. And thank you so much. I have gotten some really fantastic and extremely helpful emails from some listeners. And in fact, that is very specifically why we are extending our look into a couple of places in southern New Jersey. So thank you. You have no idea how helpful it is, but also how much I know I can trust you. As we have said before, craftlit people are just better. And you prove it time and time again in the thoughtful, kind, intelligent, and caring ways that you communicate with me. I so appreciate it. And if you haven't emailed, but you realize that you do know something about, far eastern Pennsylvania, or the same kind of slice of New Jersey, that the southern edge up against the Delaware River, Trenton and into Princeton area, please feel free to email heather@craftlit.com. I would love to hear what you have to say, because the really fascinating thing is so far, everyone who's emailed me has said pretty much the same thing. So we're triangulating what you're saying and figuring out like, nope, that one's not going to work. Oh, this one, maybe that's still on the table. Okay, well, let's take a look. So thank you. It's a long way of saying thank you. Thank you, thank you, and thank you. In my knitting world, I'm not going to do a whole lot of announcements about anything else, but in the knitting world, I did want to let you know my mom went through the heel of one of the socks that I gave her for Christmas in a month. And she was very distraught when she realized it. And I said, no, 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 this is fixable. And then I looked at it again and I thought, oh my gosh, is this really fixable? It is an epic hole. It's at least an inch and a quarter long and an inch wide. It's a lot of stitches that died. And I did a tutorial on darning socks a long time ago on the Mama O Knits blog. And it was a good tutorial. And I did it a way that I felt was good and justifiable and made a lot of sense. Since then, I've had to do a lot of these big holes, and I just had a total brainstorm on how to do this. And so I will be putting up on the Mama O Knits blog my new way of darning sock heels. It is not particularly pretty in the example that I have to show you, but it is a tighter knit heel, and all of the emphasis is on the place that people will wear through faster if you are a heavy walker, like evidently my mother and I are. So I'll be posting that as soon as I can. And I'm very happy with it. I certainly hope it works. That's, of course, the big test, isn't it? So that's my on the needles. I am working on the Vogue Map of the World Afghan for the Ravelinnet Games for the Winter Olympics. And I'm very excited about that because I'm actually making progress. And I have found that when I do intarsia, I can save myself epic amounts of time and frustration if I knit forwards and then I knit backwards. And if you've never knit backwards, my question to you is this: would it help you to have a video of me working on this bloody map of the world Afghan so that you can see how working forwards and backwards would be useful? Because I am happy to make that video. It's not particularly instructional. It's just sometimes it really helps to see someone do it. So let me know, heather@craftlit.com, if that would be of a help to you, because intarsia drives me crazy if I have to turn the piece around. I wind up twisting my yarns up and it's pathetic and I'm a mess. So all of that, good. Now on to North and South. Right then, chapter 4 in North and South. Lots has happened already. Margaret has been asked to marry Mr. Lennox, who we liked mostly. I mean, he's a little snarky, but that's fine because Margaret seems to be able to handle snark. She's a tough chick. And yet, there's some stuff about Margaret that rankled some of you. And I want to read one of those emails to you right now. Now, one of the reasons why I hadn't said some of the things that is in this email from Kathleen, Madame Defarge designer and awesome all-around person, was because I didn't want to hit this hammer too hard before we got today's chapter, chapter 4. Kathleen wrote to me, though, while we were in Florida and said, "I just finished listening to chapters 2 and 3 of North and South, and already we are getting at the issues of class and economic conflict that are key. When Margaret disdains those who are in trade, it is not just because they want to make money. It's because of how they made it through trade, which no longer referred to mercantilism alone. The term was used sneeringly by the aristocracy, upper classes, landed gentry, to refer to industrial endeavors of all types. Plenty of those sneering aristocrats had very short memories of how they came to get their land through enclosures a couple of centuries before, which created their great estates, and also conveniently disregarded the money they made in lucrative merchant trades like opium, sugar, and slaves." So Margaret sounds like a right snob, or at the very least a bit disingenuous, when she dismisses a huge part of the population, even candlestick makers. She wasn't exactly dipping her own candles and butchering her own pigs. Though she doesn't have much money, she is a lady, and the implication is that no one in trade could be a gentleman, or a lady for that matter. I think she is so happy to be in the country that she is kind of clueless about the real privations of people like old Isaac and his hovel," which struck me too. Did that get you? I noticed that too. Kathleen goes on to say about the aristocrats, "Of course, industrialism was a threat to them, both to their finances and their privilege, but as their finances worsened, they were not averse to taking flyers on schemes like railway building. Anthony Trollope's book, The Way We Live Now, is brilliant on this aspect, with lords falling all over themselves to get in bed with a sleazy Melmotte and his Mexican railway." And that, all of that, is important to keep in mind about Margaret's mindset as we head into today's chapter. There is a lot going on in and around Margaret. And one of the things that has been kind of a curiosity is Margaret is just the daughter of a parish priest, and a parish priest out in the country. I mean, it's not like he's the Archbishop of Canterbury or anything, is what I'm saying. And yet, she holds herself in such a way as to be above people. But she also reveals some things about marriage and her conception of herself as marriageable in this chapter that helps us understand her reaction to Lennox. But she's an interesting conundrum because she doesn't have money. Her mother had money. She, as far as her father goes, doesn't have money. But she was raised in London with a cousin who did have money. So by transitive property of haughtiness, she's going to be pretty high up on the haughty scale. That would be haughty, H-A-U-G-H-T-Y, and not H-O-T-T-I-E. Although she could be a haughty, for all we know. Her descriptions of herself, they're kind of curious, aren't they? She's pretty, but not that pretty. She's different looking. She's not average. You're not your average ingenue, I think is the point that Gaskell's trying to make. But we are also going to see something really curious that has frustrated scholars for an awfully long time that has to do with her father. And that is all I am going to tell you before we hear the chapter, because we have a lot to talk about afterwards. So if you're ready to listen with me, here we go with chapter 4 of North and South.
Chapter 4, Doubts and Difficulties. Cast me upon some naked shore, where I may track only the print of some sad rack. If thou be there, though the seas roar, I shall no gentler calm implore. Habington. He was gone. The house was shut up for the evening. No more deep blue skies or crimson and amber tints. Margaret went up to dress for the early tea, finding Dixon in a pretty temper from the interruption which a visitor had naturally occasioned on a busy day. She showed it by brushing away viciously at Margaret's hair, under pretense of being in a great hurry to go to Mrs. Hale. Yet, after all, Margaret had to wait a long time in the drawing room before her mother came down. She sat by herself at the fire, with unlighted candles on the table behind her, thinking over the day. A happy walk, happy sketching, cheerful, pleasant dinner, and the uncomfortable, miserable walk in the garden. How different men were to women! Here was she disturbed and unhappy because her instinct had made anything but a refusal impossible, while he, not many minutes after he had met with the rejection of what ought to have been the deepest, holiest proposal of his life, could speak as if briefs, success, and all its superficial consequences of a good house, clever and agreeable society, were the sole avowed objects of his desires. Oh dear, how she could have loved him if he had but been different, with a difference which she felt on reflection to be one that went low, deep down. Then she took it into her head that, after all, his lightness might be but assumed, to cover a bitterness of disappointment which would have been stamped on her own heart if she had loved and been rejected. Her mother came into the room before this whirl of thoughts was adjusted into anything like order. Margaret had to shake off the recollections of what had been done and said through the day and turn a sympathizing listener to the account of how Dixon had complained that the ironing blanket had been burnt again, and how Susan Lightfoot had been seen with artificial flowers in her bonnet, thereby giving evidence of a vain and giddy character. Mr. Hale sipped his tea in abstracted silence. Margaret had the responses all to herself. She wondered how her father and mother could be so forgetful, so regardless of their companion through the day, as never to mention his name. She forgot that he had not made them an offer. After tea, Mr. Hale got up and stood with his elbow on the chimney-piece, leaning his head on his hand, musing over something, and from time to time sighing deeply. Mrs. Hale went out to consult with Dixon about some winter clothing for the poor. Margaret was preparing her mother's worsted work and rather shrinking from the thought of the long evening and wishing bedtime were come that she might go over the events of the day again. "Margaret," said Mr. Hale at last, in a sort of sudden desperate way that made her start. "Is that tapestry thing of immediate consequence? I mean, can you leave it and come into my study? I want to speak to you about something very serious to us all." Very serious to us all? Mr. Lennox had never had the opportunity of having any private conversation with her father after her refusal, or else that would indeed be a very serious affair. In the first place, Margaret felt guilty and ashamed of having grown so much into a woman as to be thought of in marriage. And secondly, she did not know if her father might not be displeased that she had taken upon herself to decline Mr. Lennox's proposal. But she soon felt it was not about anything which, having only lately and suddenly occurred, could have given rise to any complicated thoughts that her father wished to speak to her. He made her take a chair by him. He stirred the fire, snuffed the candles, and sighed once or twice before he could make up his mind to say, and it came out with a jerk after all, "Margaret, I am going to leave Helston."
"Leave Helston, Papa? But why?"
Mr. Hale did not answer for a minute or two. He played with some papers on the table in a nervous and confused manner, opening his lips to speak several times, but closing them again without having the courage to utter a word. Margaret could not bear the sight of the suspense, which was even more distressing to her father than to herself.
"But why, dear Papa? Do tell me."
He looked up at her suddenly, and then said with a slow and enforced calmness,
"Because I must no longer be a minister in the Church of England."
Margaret had imagined nothing less than that some of the preferments which her mother so much desired had befallen her father at last, something that would force him to leave beautiful, beloved Helston, and perhaps compel him to go and live in some of the stately and silent closes which Margaret had seen from time to time in cathedral towns. They were grand and imposing places, but if to go there, it was necessary to leave Helston as a home forever. That would have been a sad, long, lingering pain.
But nothing to the shock she received from Mr. Hale's last speech.
What could he mean? It was all the worse for being so mysterious. The aspect of piteous distress on his face, almost as imploring a merciful and kind judgment from his child, gave her a sudden sickening. Could he have become implicated in anything Frederick had done? Frederick was an outlaw. Had her father, out of a natural love for his son, connived at any—
"Oh, what is it? Do speak, Papa, tell me all. Why can you no longer be a clergyman? Surely, if the bishop were told all we know about Frederick and the hard, unjust—"
"It is nothing about Frederick. The bishop would have nothing to do with that. It is all myself. Margaret, I will tell you about it. I will answer any questions this once. But after tonight, let us never speak of it again. I can meet the consequences of my painful, miserable doubts, but it is an effort beyond me to speak of what has caused me so much suffering."
"Doubts, Papa? Doubts as to religion?" asked Margaret, more shocked than ever.
"No, not doubts as to religion, not the slightest injury to that."
He paused. Margaret sighed, as if standing on the verge of some new horror. He began again, speaking rapidly, as if to get over a set task.
"You could not understand it all if I told you. My anxiety for years past to know whether I had any right to hold my living. my efforts to quench my smoldering doubts by the authority of the Church. Oh, Margaret, how I love the Holy Church from which I am to be shut out.
He could not go on for a moment or two. Margaret could not tell what to say. It seemed to her as terribly mysterious as if her father were about to turn Mohammedan.
I have been reading today of the 2,000 who were ejected from their churches,
continued Mr. Hale, smiling faintly,
trying to steal some of their bravery. But it is of no use, no use. I cannot help feeling it acutely.
But, Papa, have you well considered? Oh, it seems so terrible, so shocking,
said Margaret, suddenly bursting into tears. The one staid foundation of her home, of her idea of her beloved father, seemed reeling and rocking.
What could she say? What was to be done?
The sight of her distress made Mr. Hale nerve himself in order to try and comfort her. He swallowed down the dry, choking sobs which had been heaving up from his heart hitherto, and, going to his bookcase, he took down a volume which he had often been reading lately, and from which he thought he had derived strength to enter upon the course in which he was now embarked.
"Listen, dear Margaret," said he, putting one arm round her waist. She took his hand in hers and grasped it tight, but she could not lift up her head, nor, indeed, could she attend to what he read, so great was her internal agitation. "This is the soliloquy of one who was once a clergyman in a country parish like me. It was written by a Mr. Oldfield, minister of Carsington in Derbyshire, 160 years ago or more. His trials are over. He fought the good fight."
These last two sentences he spoke low, as if to himself. Then he read aloud.
"When thou canst no longer continue in thy work without dishonor to God, discredit to religion, foregoing thy integrity, wounding conscience, spoiling thy peace, and hazarding the loss of thy salvation. In a word, when the conditions upon which thou must continue, if thou wilt continue, in thy employments are sinful and unwarranted by the word of God, thou mayest, yea, thou must believe that God will turn thy very silence, suspension, deprivation, and laying aside to his glory and the advancement of the gospel's interest. When God will not use thee in one kind, yet he will in another. A soul that desires to serve and honor him shall never want opportunity to do it, nor must thou so limit the Holy One of Israel as to think he hath but one way in which he can glorify himself by thee. He can do it by thy silence as well as by thy preaching, thy laying aside as well as thy continuance in thy work. It is not pretense of doing God the greatest service or performing the weightiest duty that will excuse the least sin, though that sin capacitated or gave us the opportunity for doing that duty. Thou wilt have little thanks, O my soul, if, when thou art charged with corrupting God's worship, falsifying thy vows, thou pretendest a necessity for it in order to a continuance in the ministry. As he read this and glanced at much more which he did not read, he gained resolution for himself and felt as if he too could be brave and firm in doing what he believed to be right. But as he ceased, he heard Margaret's low, convulsive sob, and his courage sank down under the keen sense of suffering. "Margaret, dear," said he, drawing her closer, "think of the early martyrs. Think of the thousands who have suffered."
"But, Father," said she,
suddenly lifting up her flushed, tear-wet face,
"the early martyrs suffered for the truth, while you, oh, dear, dear Papa."
"I suffer for conscience' sake, my child,"
said he, with a dignity that was only tremulous from the acute sensitiveness of his character.
"I must do what my conscience bids. I have borne long with self-reproach that would have roused any mind less torpid and cowardly than mine.
He shook his head as he went on.
Your poor mother's fond wish, gratified at last in the mocking way in which overfond wishes are too often fulfilled, Sodom apples as they are, has brought on this crisis for which I ought to be, and I hope I am, thankful. It is not a month since the bishop offered me another living. If I had accepted it, I should have had to make a fresh declaration of conformity to the liturgy at my institution. Margaret, I tried to do it. I tried to content myself with simply refusing the additional preferment and stopping quietly here, strangling my conscience now, as I had strained it before. God forgive me.
He rose and walked up and down the room, speaking low words of self-reproach and humiliation, of which Margaret was thankful to hear but a few. At last he said,
Margaret, I return to the old sad burden. We must leave Helston.
Yes, I see. But when?
I have written to the bishop. I dare say I have told you so, but I forget things just now,
said Mr. Hale, collapsing into his depressed manner as soon as he came to talk of hard matter-of-fact details,
informing him of my intention to resign this vicarage. He has been most kind. He has used arguments and expostulations, all in vain. In vain. They are but what I have tried upon myself without avail. I shall have to take my deed of resignation and wait upon the bishop myself to bid him farewell. That will be a trial. But worse, far worse, will be the parting from my dear people. There is a curate appointed to read prayers, a Mr. Brown. He will come to stay with us tomorrow. Next Sunday, I preach my farewell sermon.
Was it to be so sudden then? Thought Margaret. And yet, perhaps it was just as well. Lingering would only add stings to the pain. It was better to be stunned into numbness by hearing of all these arrangements, which seemed to be nearly completed before she had been told.
What does Mamma say?
Asked she, with a deep sigh. To her surprise, her father began to walk about again before he answered.
At length, he stopped and replied, Margaret, I am a poor coward after all. I cannot bear to give pain. I know so well your mother's married life has not been all she hoped, all she had a right to expect. And this will be such a blow to her that I have never had the heart, the power to tell her. She must be told, though, now,
said he, looking wistfully at his daughter. Margaret was almost overpowered with the idea that her mother knew nothing of it all, and yet the affair was so far advanced.
Yes, indeed she must, said Margaret. Perhaps, after all, she may not. Oh, yes, she will. She must be shocked.
As the force of the blow returned upon herself in trying to realize how another would take it.
Where are we to go?
Said she at last, struck with a fresh wonder as to their future plans, if plans indeed her father had.
To Milton Northern,
he answered with a dull indifference. For he had perceived that, although his daughter's love had made her cling to him, and for a moment strive to soothe him with her love, yet the keenness of the pain was as fresh as ever in her mind.
Milton Northern? The manufacturing town in Darkshire?
Yes, said he in the same despondent, indifferent way.
Why there, Papa?
Asked she.
Because there I can earn bread for my family. Because I know no one there, and no one knows Helston or can ever talk to me about it.
Bread for your family? I thought you and Mamma had...
And then she stopped, checking her natural interest regarding their future life, as she saw the gathering gloom on her father's brow. But he, with his quick intuitive sympathy, read in her face, as in a mirror, the reflections of his own moody depression, and turned it off with an effort.
"You shall be told all, Margaret. Only help me to tell your mother. I think I could do anything but that. The idea of her distress turns me sick with dread. If I tell you all, perhaps you could break it to her tomorrow? I am going out for the day to bid Farmer Dobson and the poor people on Bracy Common goodbye. Would you dislike breaking it to her very much, Margaret?"
Margaret did dislike it, did shrink from it more than from anything she had ever had to do in her life before. She could not speak all at once. Her father said,
"You dislike it very much, don't you, Margaret?" Then she conquered herself and said, with a bright, strong look on her face,
"It is a painful thing, but it must be done, and I will do it as well as ever I can. You must have many painful things to do."
Mr. Hale shook his head despondingly. He pressed her hand in token of gratitude. Margaret was nearly upset again into a burst of crying. To turn her thoughts, she said,
"Now tell me, Papa, what our plans are. You and Mama have some money, independent of the income from the living, have not you? Aunt Shaw has, I know."
"Yes, I suppose we have about £170 a year of our own. 70 of that has always gone to Frederick since he has been abroad. I don't know if he wants it all,"
he continued in a hesitating manner.
"He must have some pay for serving with the Spanish army."
"Frederick must not suffer," said Margaret decidedly, "in a foreign country, so unjustly treated by his own. 100 is left. Could not you and I and Mama live on 100 a year in some very cheap, very quiet part of England? Oh, I think we could."
"No," said Mr. Hale, "that would not answer. I must do something. I must make myself busy to keep off morbid thoughts. Besides, in a country parish, I should be so painfully reminded of Helston and my duties here. I could not bear it, Margaret. And 100 a year would go a very little way after the necessary wants of housekeeping are met towards providing your mother with all the comforts she has been accustomed to and ought to have. No, we must go to Milton. That is settled. I can always decide better by myself and not influenced by those whom I love," said he, as a half-apology for having arranged so much before he had told any one of his family of his intentions. "I cannot stand objections. They make me so undecided."
Margaret resolved to keep silence. After all, what did it signify where they went compared to the one terrible change? Mr. Hale continued,
"A few months ago, when my misery of doubt became more than I could bear without speaking, I wrote to Mr. Bell. You remember Mr. Bell, Margaret?"
"No, I never saw him, I think. But I know who he is. Frederick's godfather, your old tutor at Oxford, don't you mean?"
"Yes, he is a fellow of Plymouth College there. He is a native of Milton Northern, I believe. At any rate, he has property there, which has very much increased in value since Milton has become such a large manufacturing town. Well, I had reason to suspect, to imagine. I had better say nothing about it, however. But I felt sure of sympathy from Mr. Bell. I don't know that he gave me much strength. He has lived an easy life in his college all his days, but he has been as kind as can be, and it is owing to him we are going to Milton."
"How?" said Margaret.
"Why, he has tenants and houses and mills there, so though he dislikes the place, too bustling for one of his habits, he is obliged to keep up some sort of connection, and he tells me that he hears there is a good opening for a private tutor there."
"A private tutor?" said Margaret, looking scornful. "What in the world do manufacturers want with the classics or literature or the accomplishments of a gentleman?"
"Oh," said her father, "some of them really seem to be fine fellows, conscious of their own deficiencies, which is more than many a man at Oxford is. Some want resolutely to learn, though they have come to man's estate. Some want their children to be better instructed than they themselves have been. At any rate, there is an opening, as I have said, for a private tutor. Mr. Bell has recommended me to a Mr. Thornton, a tenant of his, and a very intelligent man as far as I can judge from his letters. And in Milton, Margaret, I shall find a busy life, if not a happy one, and people and scenes so different that I shall never be reminded of Helston. There was the secret motive, as Margaret knew from her own feelings. It would be different, discordant as it was, with almost a detestation for all she had ever heard of the north of England, the manufacturers, the people, the wild and bleak country. There was this one recommendation. It would be different from Helston, and could never remind them of that beloved place.
"When do we go?" asked Margaret after a short silence.
"I do not know exactly. I wanted to talk it over with you. You see, your mother knows nothing about it yet. But I think, in a fortnight, after my deed of resignation is sent in, I shall have no right to remain."
Margaret was almost stunned.
"In a fortnight?"
No, not exactly to a day. Nothing is fixed," said her father with anxious hesitation, as he noticed the filmy sorrow that came over her eyes and the sudden change in her complexion. But she recovered herself immediately.
"Yes, Papa, it had better be fixed soon and decidedly, as you say. Only Mama to know nothing about it. It is that is the great perplexity."
"Poor Maria," replied Mr. Hale tenderly. Poor Maria. Oh, if I were not married, if I were but myself in the world, how easy it would be. As it is, Margaret, I dare not tell her."
"No," said Margaret sadly. "I will do it. Give me till tomorrow evening to choose my time."
"Oh, Papa,"
cried she with sudden passionate entreaty.
"Say, tell me it is a nightmare, a horrid dream, not the real waking truth. You cannot mean that you are really going to leave the church, to give up Helston, to be forever separate from me, from Mama, led away by some delusion, some temptation. You do not really mean it."
Mr. Hale sat in rigid stillness while she spoke. Then he looked her in the face and said in a slow, hoarse, measured way, "I do mean it, Margaret. You must not deceive yourself into doubting the reality of my words, my fixed intention, and resolve." He looked at her in the same steady, stony manner for some moments after he had done speaking. She, too, gazed back with pleading eyes before she would believe that it was irrevocable. Then she arose and went, without another word or look, towards the door. As her fingers were on the handle, he called her back. He was standing by the fireplace, shrunk and stooping. But as she came near, he drew himself up to his full height, and, placing his hands on her head, he said solemnly, "The blessing of God be upon thee, my child."
"And may he restore you to his church," responded she, out of the fullness of her heart.
The next moment she feared lest this answer to his blessing might be irreverent, wrong, might hurt him as coming from his daughter, and she threw her arms around his neck. He held her to him for a minute or two. She heard him murmur to himself, "The martyrs and confessors had even more pain to bear. I will not shrink." They were startled by hearing Mrs. Hale inquiring for her daughter. They started asunder in the full consciousness of all that was before them. Mr. Hale hurriedly said, "Go, Margaret, go. I shall be out all tomorrow. Before night, you will have told your mother."
"Yes," she replied,
and she returned to the drawing room in a stunned and dizzy state.
So there you have it. This particular piece of North and South has confounded scholars, some scholars. Other scholars I've found seem to be able to find some way to explain Gaskell doing this with Mr. Hale. Interestingly enough, Charlotte Bronte, who's a friend of Gaskell's, and Charles Dickens both thought in reading the first few chapters that Mr. Hale's decision was going to play very heavily in the course of this book. Now, Charlotte Bronte's response to this, as the daughter of an Anglican minister, even though he held some dissenting beliefs, he was still part of the CV, her response was kind of to groan and say, oh, please don't go there. Dickens' response was to say, you told me you weren't going to do that, so cut it out, because they'd had a lot of discussions about the book before he agreed to publish it. Now, it will probably take me until we're done with the book to actually make sense of all of this for you. So you're going to hear bits and pieces kind of trickling through. There will be, you know, chapter 37, and I'll say, oh, and another thing I just learned about Mr. Hale and why he did that, because it's a really complicated problem. And it covers, as far as I've been able to understand so far, it covers all of these things. Number one, it covers the fact that in the late 1500s, the 39 articles were set down as, I believe, part of the Common Book of Prayer in the Anglican Church. And among these articles are things that, I guess, in the 9th and the 36th, I think, of these articles, there are things that specifically deal with the creation, the continuation of a parliamentary religion, that is, a state religion, one that people are beholden to, one that people have to pay taxes to. And Hale specifically mentions the parliamentary religion thing. Now, some people have, I think, rather cynically said this was just Gaskell's machination to try and move the Hale family to the North, because she had to create this dichotomy between the South and the North, even though she had wanted to name the book Margaret Hale and not North and South. Even knowing that there's still a large body of critics, literary criticism critics, not like, wow, that stunk, but literary criticism types of critics, people who know what they're talking about, who think that this was a fairly contrived gimmick to move them to the North. I personally think it's more interesting than that for a couple of reasons. One, Elizabeth Gaskell's mother died either right after she was born, during her birth, right after she was born, or within the first 2 years. I honestly can't remember, because I've been reading a lot this week about the religion thing. Gaskell lived with her father for a little bit longer, then he remarried, and she wound up going to live with an aunt up in the country. Actually, she was in Stratford upon Avon, which is kind of cool. I will confirm that later. Don't take that as gospel yet. So her father, who she's not really estranged from him, because there doesn't seem to be any animosity. It's just he's got a new family and she's not part of it, and she doesn't get to see her dad a whole lot. He was a Unitarian minister, so he was a dissenter. He was, and this is where it gets really complicated for me. They're in England. He is a minister. He has a congregation, but he's Unitarian. And that means that he has not agreed to the 39 articles of faith. And the thing that's really interesting to me as an outsider is it looks like most of the 39 articles, anyone who's Christian could probably agree with. But there are a couple that might kind of stick in your craw. And there was one particular scholar who I thought did a really interesting job of parsing the language and showing how, someone who is particularly thoughtful and also particularly aware of language and the power of words, and someone who believes that words mean something, because, as you know, in the beginning there was the word, that kind of thing. Let's see, it's the 36th article, says something about that he alloweth the book of articles, and that he acknowledgeth the same to be agreeable to the word of God. And this scholar points out that we can allow a lot of things that we don't necessarily think are brilliant or correct or whatever. I can allow that there are Holocaust deniers out there, but I'm not necessarily going to acknowledge their argument as legitimate. That's two completely different things. And for someone like Hale, who clearly takes his job very seriously and thinks a great deal about it and cares a great deal about it, this could really become a problem. There was another one that said, whomsoever shall hereafter affirm that any of the 39 articles, etc., are in any part superstitious or erroneous, or such as he may not with a good conscience subscribe unto, let him be excommunicated. That's the line that got a lot of those, he referred to them as martyrs, the people who were kicked out of the church back a couple hundred years before this. That's where they had their sticking point. There were things that they just could no longer, in good conscience and good faith, agree to. And that's a problem. And the thing that I think is important about all of this, when it comes down to it, isn't that it doesn't matter, because I think it does matter a great deal. I think the important thing is that it shows us, really rather early on, that Gaskell is trying to play fair. Henry Lennox is a lawyer. He can be snarky, sure, but he's also a real person, and he likes to go sketching, and he actually has kind of a talent for it. And he is a kind, interesting, interested man. He's not an NGB. He's not a nice guy, but he's a good guy. But Margaret isn't there yet. And as she said in this chapter, she was kind of embarrassed at someone even thinking about her as a possible wife. She's just not there. And Haley, it would be too easy. It would be too facile to just write him off as some bumbling clergyman who can't quite get his act together and sign on to something. That's not true. And he's not that guy. He's not Rowan Atkinson in Three Weddings and a Funeral. He's not Mowage. He's a real guy with real doubts. And I think what's important for us early on in the book is to become very clear in our minds and in our hearts that Elizabeth Gaskell is going to do her best to play fair with everyone. And that means if she meets an atheist, she is going to treat the atheist with respect. If she met a Jew in this book, she would treat the Jew with respect. And yes, she did have that throwaway line that this was as shocking as if her father had become a Mohammedan. Now, in today's world, that is kind of affronting, because that's a complete misnomer. We talked about this back when we did Frankenstein. Muslims do not treat Muhammad as God. He's a prophet. And so to call them Mohammedans is really just wrong. And yet I felt like you could insert anything into that line. It would be as shocking as if her father had become a Buddhist. It would be as shocking as if her father had become a Jew. It was, you could insert anything, and it would all have been just as shocking. Because again, we're talking about a state religion. Any deviation from that track is going to be shocking. And yet, Gaskell treats Hale with respect, She treats Margaret with respect. She treats Lennox with respect. We haven't seen a whole lot of Mrs. Hale yet, so we don't know how that's going to go. But we've also learned something, again, thinking about this as Margaret Hale's book instead of North and South, the dichotomy. We've learned something very interesting about Margaret. She may be biased in her own mind about people and class and things like that. But when push comes to shove, this woman is tough. Her father can't bear to tell her mother that they're going to move in 20 days. So Margaret has to do it. Doesn't want to, but willingly accepts that burden. You're going to see a lot more of this from this young woman. And I've read a lot of kind of college-ish essays, or at least they read as college essays, and even some stuff from scholars who are like, women during the Victorian time were never like this. This would have been unthinkable. No one could possibly have been like this. And so she's really promoting a radical feminist view of women. And I think that's a bunch of bunk, right? Because women who didn't have access to money certainly had to be tough. And even women who did have access to money, they may have had to be sneakier about the way that they did things around some men, not all men, but some men. But you can't tell me that women were weak and weak and weak and weak and weak until suddenly in 1967, they became empowered. I don't buy it for a second. Gaskell was a strong woman. She was a mother. She was a wife. And she probably would have listed them in that order. She loved her daughters and her son, loved her husband, who was, by the way, a Unitarian minister. But she went and traveled on her own or with a friend. Nothing stopped her. So she's very much a picture of a perfect Victorian wife and an author who's making more money than her husband and travels where she wants to, when she wants to, and has lots of really interesting friends. So, you know, you put those two things together and you go, okay, women in the Victorian era, probably more complicated than we thought. And perhaps Marion in The Woman in White really wasn't that extraordinary in the grand scheme of things. Maybe what was extraordinary was that someone had the cojones to write about her, like Wilkie Collins and Elizabeth Gaskell. And as I'm learning about Middlemarch, George Eliot. So as I continue to read on this incredibly complicated and intricate problem of religious dissension in England during the mid 1800s, I will be feeding you what I learn when I learn it, if it's valuable at all, to the story that we're reading. But there's a lot of stuff going on early on in the book. And, you know, it's funny because when I first read the book, I felt like the beginning was really kind of sleepy, you know, yawn, okay. And then this chapter happened and I thought, huh, okay, well, that's new. And pretty much from this point on, I was hooked. Certainly by the time they get to Milton. Milton, Northern, is a stand-in for Manchester. I know you're shocked. And Darkshire is a stand-in for Lancashire. Everybody knew that. It wasn't a surprise. But that was how Gaskell chose to write it. There doesn't seem to be any real rule about this convention. We've certainly heard it before. In Jane Eyre, it was Blankshire, where it was just a line, a blank line, and then Shire, S-H-I-R-E. Different writers seem to have done it different ways. But there's no question that this is Manchester, which Elizabeth Gaskell lived near-ish, and Lancashire County, where Manchester is. It's not a surprise that she named it Milton, even though it's spelled Milton like the poet, M-I-L-T-O-N. It is Mill, M-I-L-L, town, T-O-W-N. It is a mill town. That's where they're moving to. Oh, and Plymouth College at Oxford is not really a college at Oxford. So if you know anything about Oxford and you went, what? That's why. So now that I've fed you all this information, I really didn't want to tell you all of this before you listen to the chapter. But now that you have all this information, you might want to go back and listen to Hale again. And in particular, listen to his conversation, his side of the conversation with Margaret, because he does try to explain his thinking. And Oldfield, who he quotes from, was a Unitarian scholar, had been a minister, was one of the people who were excommunicated. And within the Unitarian world at the time, he was quite well known. So Gaskell's Unitarian readers would absolutely have known what she was pulling out of her bag of tricks with that one. But even people who weren't Unitarian might have had a fairly clear picture of who he was. And he's quite well respected, at least within the Unitarian community, from what I understand. So it might be worth going back and letting that one roll over you again just to get it clear. And not because Hale or Hale's dilemma becomes such an important turning point or anything for the book, because really we have to get to Milton. But more because I think it shows us a lot about Gaskell and the care that she took with building a narrative that stood on a firm basis of reality, no matter how C of E readers might have taken this act of dissension. She was trying to put Hale in a position where he could explain himself to the satisfaction of everyone and still be basically a likable character, a character that you feel like you could understand, you could agree to disagree with because he was a gentleman. And that was a really interesting tightrope that I think Gaskell was walking at the time. So I'm sure I'll have more on this for you later as I read more. But for now, I hope that helps clarify a little bit about what Gaskell was up to in this chapter. And of course, why for Margaret this would have been a shock. Margaret is still very much a Church of England girl, and so is her mother. And now her father is dissenting, and that would be really rather nerve-wracking because it denies everything that she's lived within for her entire life. And that's a fairly tricky thing. So on that sobering note, I will leave you, and I'll talk to you next week. Take care. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, or via our Android, our new Windows 8, or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Craftlit is and has been made possible by the support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.